Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defense Podcast. I'm your host, Noemi Di Stefano, and if this is the first time you're joining us, welcome to the show. This is a space where every week the Shepherd's News team take a look at the major headlines from the defense sector, focusing on defense procurement and military technology. So let's find out who from the team is with us today. Harry Lai, our senior naval reporter at the Naval Desk. Hi, Harry. Good morning.
Hi, Noemi.
Hiya, military training editor Trevor Nash. Hi, Trevor. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Naomi. Good morning.
And at the air desk, we got our air editor, Tim Martin. Morning to you, Tim.
Hi, morning, Naomi.
So just before we start, just to give our listeners an overview of what we'll be talking about today, we've got a couple of stories concerning both the UK and the US navies. We will look at the upcoming replacement of one of the UK Royal Air Force platforms. And in the second part of the show, we will dive into the world of cyberspace and talk Joint All Domain Control and Communication, or JADC2, with Viasat. Now, I want to go around the tables to start with and see what stories you guys have been looking at this week. Harry, let's start from you and a new export deal for the UK with Egypt.
Yeah, so an out-of-nowhere announcement was that the UK had sold two former RFA fleet auxiliaries to Egypt as part of a kind of a government-to-government sale. And there's the potential for Camel Laird in Birkenhead to refurbish the vessels, and negotiations for that are ongoing.
What is, would you say, the significance of this deal?
The UK was keen to point out that this is the first time it's sold ships to Egypt for over 30 years. So the ships were decommissioned earlier this year following the integrated review. And probably the most significant thing, though, is that these vessels are eventually going to be replaced in the UK by the fleet solid support ships. But that competition has stalled a couple of times and is on some pretty slow going. A contract is out for it now for kind of the first phase, but it's still going to be a good probably 5 years, maybe even longer, up until 2028 that we could actually see one of those ships enter into service.
Okay, and in terms of exports to Egypt, could it be, would you say, the start of a new trend in exports to this country? Are there any other ships within the UK that are approaching the end of their service life that Egypt could be interested in?
So DESA, the UK's kind of defence equipment selling authority, has got a few more ships up for grabs. There's RFA Argus, the primary casualty receiver, HMS Scott, Type 23 frigates. There's plenty of ships up for sale, but they've said that they're not in negotiations with Egypt for any more vessels.
Thank you, Harry. We'll be back to you later to discuss other UK Royal Navy matters. But since we're talking about exports, it's worth mentioning that on the 26th of October, the UK government published statistics that gave an overview of how Britain performed in the global exports market in 2020, but also in the last decade compared to both EU and non-EU competitors. So the report from the UK Defence and Security Exports highlights that in 2020, the UK secured more or less £8 billion worth of export contracts, which when we look at 2019, where the deals were worth £11 billion, we will see a fall in 2020, which amounts to 28%. Now, I have looked at contributing factors for the 2020 dip, but also at which regions of the world the UK is exporting to more. And I have cross-checked the DSE data against other documents released by other organisations, which perhaps use different methodologies. And I've put all of that together in an article with infographics that you can find on our website, shepherdmedia.com. Okay, so export chapter over. Trevor, training stories from you this week. What have you got for us?
Well, I think one of the interesting ones is the fact that the UK has looked at replacing what was called ASDOT, Air Support for Defence Operational Training, an air-based contract which was canned in early 2019 because the Treasury refused to sanction it going through what's called main gate, i.e. the funding for the programme. And they've got another programme now, which is not necessarily replacing ASDOT. It's only replacing certain parts of ASDOT. And that programme is called the Operational Readiness Training Aerial Support Service. That's just raised its head. What is interesting about that programme is that they want a solution which will be fielded from mid-2022, i.e. less than 9 months' time now.
Is it that feasible at all?
It is feasible if they know who's going to win the competition and that person has been in discussions already. Because it clearly does not give time for consortia to come together, sort out their teaming arrangements, bid for the programme, and then the MOD to go through all those particular bids. And the MOD have got this on a fast-track system for procurement. So my guess is that they already know who's going to get it. And my belief is that Draken Europe will get the programme. They already operate the Falcon 20 EW aircraft. They've got the ability to use fast jet aggressors by using some of their own aircraft from the US. So I think it's a done deal. And I think a Draken Europe team will actually get that contract.
Okay, very interesting, Trevor. Thank you very much. I'll be back to you soon. Tim, what have you been working on this week on the Air Desk?
Yeah, so of an interesting one, which actually thanks to Harry on the tip-off, which is a replacement programme for the RAF's BAE-146 aircraft. So there's a fleet of four that are going to be retired in 2022. So this procurement, which is known as the Command Support Air Transport Recapitalisation, or CSAT recap for short, was initially released on the 20th of October, and I think what's really interesting is that the RAF are effectively cutting the Command Air Transport Force from four aircraft, as I mentioned, to just two. So in terms of the details and what's required, industry are expected to, for a 2-year contract, to deliver up to 980 flying hours in the first year and then 1200 flying hours in the second year as well, and then the whatever aircraft they're proposing must be able to achieve a minimum unrefueled range of 3850 nautical miles. So that's the long and short of it in terms of what the MOD are asking for, and then industry have until the 29th of November to submit bids under what's called a CSAT recap phase one. And then the second phase, which is effectively an additional competitive procurement, will be for modifications to be military modifications, I should say, to be made to the aircraft from 2024 onwards. But that bit is separate and clearly comes at a later date. But for now, the focus is in procuring those two new aircraft and getting them delivered from 2022.
Okay, just for a little bit of background, so what is how does this capabilities of the Royal Air Force, what is it used for?
So the Royal Air Force, they operate from RAF Northolt, these aircraft, and so the configurations, there's two. So there's a VIP variant, which is the CC Mark II, and then there's the quick change C Mark III variants. And so the fleet overall is used for transport of the Royal Family, senior government figures, and then MOD civilian personnel. And then outside of that kind of VIP and civilian focus, they've also been used in operations in Afghanistan, Iraq for counterinsurgency, and then for NATO-led missions in Libya. So, yeah, it's somewhat of a crossover platform in terms of basic military capabilities. But I think what's interesting in terms of the major headline that will come from this is that I should have mentioned actually at the top that this is funding of £80 million being put forward for as I say, just the two aircraft. But this is essentially cutting the capability in half from four aircraft to two.
But I just wanted to ask you, so what is the reason for cutting from four to two? Is it cost?
Well, no, it's not officially, at least, the cost, but you'd imagine that actually there is some truth to that. But officially, the MOD line is, I'll just read it here, the procurement of two modern efficient aircraft with longer range are deemed sufficient to meet the CSAT requirement. So, you know, that's an indication of the MOD suggesting that they can get the necessary capabilities just from two aircraft. So there's no need to be buying four. So that no indication of financial difficulties being referenced there from the spokesperson who provided me with a statement.
Okay, and in terms of platforms that could substitute it, I know it's still early days, but do you have any idea of who from industry might come forward or what platforms might come forward for this replacement?
It's a great question, and to be fairly frank, the business jet market really isn't my strong suit. So I'm sure I'll have some listeners complaining and asking me to up my game and so forth, but I'm not in the loop, on who is going to compete for this one. I mean, suppose what I did a little bit of background and information gathering in terms of, you know, what's kind of prolific or what's the new shiny toy, let's say, in the business jet market, and in terms of looking at costs. So if you take away the provision for up to 3 years of additional support for this requirement, which is $18 million, you take that away then from the unit costs of roughly, or the whole tender, I suppose, overall from $80 million, you're left clearly with $62 million or £31 million a piece for each of the aircraft. So in terms of what the UK would be getting for that, well, that type of money wouldn't buy something like the Gulfstream G650, which is kind of the market leader on the business jet front, and comes in with a price tag of $66.5 million or dollars, that should be, sorry, so about 48 million pounds. So yeah, that clearly there's a discrepancy between the amount of money that the UK would be putting forward here at $31 million and trying to buy something like that to be per aircraft to be about £16 million short. Having said all that, though, and again, just to give a full sense of this, you know, that those aircraft might be just too far in advance of what the MOD require, you know, and there could be others in the round at the £30 million mark that fit the requirements. Or having said that, then the UK might dip into the second hand market.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Trevor, do you want to say something about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Tim, with that last comment about the second-hand market. I mean, if you look at similar requirements throughout Europe, the Germans, for instance, use Airbus aeroplanes, you know, the twin-engine 320-319 type for that. A lot of air forces use that. And the other one could well be second-hand Boeing 737s, because if you look, the RAF operates P-8, 737-based. It's getting wedge-tail 737-based. So I guess maybe if they operated these two new aircraft, there would be savings there in terms of logistic support. But, you know, who knows? Shouldn't apply common sense too much, should we?
Yeah, let's wait and see. But, yeah, good addition there to the conversation, certainly, Trevor. And maybe you're saving me from some embarrassment on the business jet front. So I really appreciate that, certainly.
Harry, do you want to add something on this as well?
I was just going to say it'll be interesting to see if they paint a big Union Jack on the tail of it when they do eventually buy them.
whatever would give you that impression, Harry.
Okay, thank you, Tim, and thank you, everyone, for discussing this story. And Tim, I'm sure that our listeners will understand. And actually, if they've got a comment, they can leave it down below on whatever podcast directory they are listening from. So let's move from the skies to the seas. And Harry, back to you, because you wrote a story on an ongoing debate within the UK Royal Navy for the replacement of Harpoon missiles. So what is the plan? What is the debate about?
So the plan is that there's multiple plans and they don't know which one to pick, essentially. So earlier this week at the House of Commons Defence Committee, you had the DENS Director General Ships, the First Sea Lord and Minister for Defence Procurement, Jeremy Quinn, giving evidence. And during the hearing, what came up was the plan to replace the Harpoon missile, which is due to be phased out in December 2023. That's the out of service date. At current, once that goes out of service, the RN will essentially have a greatly diminished surface-to-surface missile capability and would pretty much be relying on Martlet and Sea Venom on the Wildcat helicopters. Obviously, that's not ideal. It will work, but it would be good to have some surface-to-surface missiles. So there's a debate going on within the RN as to whether to buy an interim solution that would fill the gap immediately, or not quite immediately after Harpoon goes out of service, but give you some capability to bridge the gap until you then have the Future Cruise anti-ship weapon come into service, which is a UK-French MBDA project. Or the alternative is you don't buy an interim solution and you simply gap the capability and wait till you can bring a brand new, longer range, faster flying missile into service.
To your knowledge, though, would the Royal Navy then consider to extend the life of the Harpoon or just prefer to leave that capability gap?
An extension of Harpoon is possible, but given the age of the UK systems, they would be pretty much on their very last legs by 2027, 2028.
Did the First Sea Lord talk about capability gaps, Harry, in terms of protecting our two brand new shiny carriers?
He did talk about capability gaps in general, but from what I heard, there wasn't any particular reference to the actual carriers themselves. When I've spoken to the MOD about this in the past, they've given off the suggestion that they're confident that get post 2023 they will have sufficient surface to surface capability. But obviously, if that's just helicopter launched missiles, it's not quite the same. And it's worth mentioning that Sea Venom isn't in service yet. Martlet has been operationally fired, but Sea Venom isn't in service yet either.
Okay, interesting. Do you know when we might find out what the decision is?
No. Essentially, is the answer to that question. Future Cruise anti-ship weapon has been caught up in AUKUS. So the UK Defence Minister and his French counterpart were meant to have a meeting in September where they were going to discuss the next phase of the Future Cruise anti-ship weapon. That meeting got cancelled. It still hasn't taken place. Obviously, the French were very upset about what happened with AUKUS and losing the Australian submarine deal. And then since then, everyone's arguing about fish. So relations aren't exactly in the best place. And so when that meeting takes place is up in the air, really.
Thank you, Harry. Let's go to Trevor again and move from the UK Royal Navy to the US Navy and look at the training side of things. So, Trevor, you look at the Navy Aviation Vision 2030-2035 report, which I understand focuses a lot on training. So give us an overview of how the report addresses the training needs.
It's very interesting, Naomi. The Navy Aviation Vision, we've seen the unclassified version. There is a classified version. But even in the unclassified version, there's a heck of a lot about training, as you rightly say. And I think for ease of reference, we can split that into new aircraft programs, current projects and new initiatives. In terms of new aircraft, we've already seen some traction on that in terms of the TH-57BC being replaced gradually by the TH-73 helicopter to undertake rotary wing training. That's going quite well, as we understand it. The next aircraft to be recapitalized, as the Americans and everybody else calls it now, I prefer the word replaced. But anyway, the next aircraft to be recapitalized is the T-44, which is a twin-engined Beech King Air, basically, which is used for multi-engine training. And that's being replaced under a project called METS, Multi-Engine Training System. And that's expected to come into service in FY25. And then the really big replacement program is for the T-45C, the advanced jet trainer that the US Navy operates. And that is going to be replaced under a program called the Undergraduate Jet Training System, UJTS. And as we understand it, there are three competitors going for that at the moment, one being Boeing with the T-7. Leonardo, obviously very interested. They appear to be pitching their M346. And finally, we've got Lockheed Martin in team with Korean Aerospace with the T-50. So those are the three aeroplanes that are being considered for that particular program. Another thing, of course, which they're looking at on the new aircraft system is the MQ-25A. So they're going to be starting training people for that particular platform. The operators of that are going to be called air vehicle officers, and that training program starts in FY22. Current projects, well, Project Avenger, we've written about that before quite a lot. That's very similar to the US Air Force's pilot training Next initiative, which attempts to have competency-based learning. So in other words, the training pilot using head-mounted displays, haptic feedback, very low-cost simulators, they can move through the system a lot quicker than a conventional course where everybody's got to do a test after every phase and everybody moves through together. So that's ongoing. Project Hellcat, that is another interesting project which we don't know too much about. But basically what it's trying to do is to take training from the strike aircraft, the FA-18s, and the F-35s, and move some of that training onto the T-6B turboprop. And although they're completely different aircraft types and their capabilities are completely different, there are certain things that you can move down onto a lower cost airframe. That, of course, saves training costs on a higher cost airframe later on. And then finally, the current project is Corsair, which is looking to modify the T-45C, the Goshawk training syllabus. And again, that is looking to download expensive conversion training from the F-35 and FA-18. The Americans, we in the UK, we call them operational conversion units. The American Navy calls them FRSs. And again, it's trying to get expensive high-end training down to lower cost platforms.
Okay, just one thing. So by reading your story, I understand that the emphasis is the aim here is to revolutionize training in a way. And these initiatives that you mentioned are all part of that vision of providing high-end training in a way. There was one of them, which is the chief of naval air training, is called Sinatra. So that one, in your story, you focus a lot on that. Can you tell us what changes we will need to see on that front?
Yes, you've got two major organisations, really. Sinatra gives the leadership, provides the training. It's the intellectual engine, if you will, behind training.
Okay.
And Sinatra is totally, fully supported by an organisation called NORC TSD, which is Naval Air Warfare Centre Training Systems Division. They're based in Orlando, and they procure and provide the management of the particular program. So they work; those two organizations work very closely together.
Okay. Then I'm curious to understand, what, in your opinion, what are the challenges ahead then for the U.S. in the path to renewing and rethinking the training methods?
in terms of, let me just talk about new initiatives first, if I may. And
yes, sure.
What they're also doing is they're looking at adversary training, which we talk about quite a lot, but they're also talking about fleet surrogates.
Okay.
So a fleet surrogate, as they see it, is an aeroplane, a fast jet aeroplane, which is not as expensive to operate as an F/A-18 or an F-35, but with multifunction glass display cockpits, they can reconfigure those cockpits to actually copy the instrumentation of the, you know, the strike aircraft, as they call them. So this document said that those lower cost aeroplanes, those surrogates, could be operated at around about 15% of the cost of operating an F-35. And so what they're looking at is getting this undergraduate jet training system to replace the T-45 to undertake that role, to undertake the fleet surrogate role, and also to undertake the adversary role. So one aeroplane, three roles. If that happens, that's going to be very interesting in terms of cost saving, and also for the eventual winner, it will be a massive contract. In their new initiatives as well, they're currently looking at integrating all of their simulators, networking all of them, the F-18, EA-18, E-2, F-35, P-8, MH-60E, Romeo and Sierra, and the MQ-25 simulators integrated into a network, and then using integrated live virtual constructive training at two bases on the Pacific and on the Atlantic coast. So this complete vision is absolutely massive. So coming back to your question, Naomi, and that is the challenge. Well, the challenge is twofold. One is getting the money to do it. And secondly, is it's going to be a long-term project. And as we all know, in any country in the world, we have staff officers coming into position for 2.5 to 3 years. So to maintain that drive, the thrust of fulfilling the vision with personnel changing on a regular basis is going to be pretty difficult. But, you know, a lot of people don't understand that the US Navy were one of the prime drivers globally in terms of the use of simulation and training, adopting new training techniques. So if anybody can do it, the US Navy can.
Thank you, Trevor. Just the last question on this, I have to ask because I'm very curious. So a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the live versus training ongoing debate. Is it okay to train 90% in a synthetic environment? What happens when then the trainees go to war and they are 100% in a live environment? So I wanted to ask you, how does the Navy Aviation Vision, or if it does it at all, address this kind of debate? Is there an intent of rebalancing the two, would you say, in the document?
Do you know, Naomi, that's a brilliant question, because the Royal Air Force has now decided to go to 80% simulator, 20% live training. In this document, the US Navy say that simulator training is excellent and it has its place, but reading between the lines, it places greater importance on live training. So, you know, the cost of operating these frontline strike aeroplanes, I mean, for instance, whether it's still costing $40,000 an hour to operate the F-35 or 38, as Lockheed Martin say, the fact of the matter is they're very expensive to operate. So it's very interesting that instead of just taking that time to go into the simulator, the US Navy are looking at these fleet surrogates to keep pilots flying in real aeroplanes. And that's what they recognize the advantages. So, you know, although we keep talking about it, Naomi, this live virtual balance, there's still stacks of discussion to be had around it. And still, there needs to be some proper studies as to, you know, what the correct balance is.
Okay, thank you, Trevor. And thanks all for joining me today. And for our listeners, you can find out more about our weekly coverage, previous episodes of the podcast, video content and more on our website, shepherdmedia.com/news. And as I mentioned earlier, if you want to share your view on any of the topics that we discussed in this episode, please go ahead and leave a comment on whatever platform you are joining us from. Time now for a short break. We will be back in a few moments, this time with our news editor Ben Vogel in conversation with Viasat to dive into the fascinating world of the Internet of Things. Stay with us.
From your home office
to out at sea
to on mission, Shepherd News is used by more than 4 million government, military and industry professionals across the globe. So what are you waiting for? Start your 14-day free trial to premium news and join ranks with those in the know. Head to shepherdmedia.com/subscribe today.
Multi-domain integration and the connected battle space were two prominent topics for discussion in the recent DSEI and AUSA industry events. But what is actually being achieved and how is industry participating? With me to discuss these and other topics is Craig Miller, President of Government Systems at Viasat. Hello, Craig, and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast.
Hey, Ben. Good morning or good afternoon for you. Thanks for having me here. Looking forward to the discussion. I think these are definitely some interesting topics and that there's a lot of energy and discussion on both sides of the pond here around MDI, as you guys call it. We call it JADC2 or Joint All Domain Command and Control here. But however you arrange the acronym soup, I think it's a really interesting new capability about basically bringing formerly stovepiped users together in new ways.
Okay, so speaking of JADC2, that was a topic of a lot of discussion, as I mentioned in the intro, at the recent AUSA meeting. Can you explain how Viasat is involved in this program, and can you relay any lessons learned to date?
Yeah, and so JADC2, like MDI, it is a really ambitious initiative, and it's more than one program. The individual services have their own implementations of JADC2, if you will, in the United States. And so the Air Force has advanced battle management services. The Navy has Project Overmatch. The Army has Project Convergence, et cetera. And all of these things together are ways to bring new users together. And Viasat has, you know, throughout our three-decade history, we've excelled at doing that. And so we're participating in a number of different ways. And so our portfolio includes satellite communications solutions. It includes tactical data link solutions. It includes cryptographic and information assurance products. And one of the strengths of Viasat, one of the things that Viasat's really good at doing, is finding ways to bring all those things together. And so we use our crypto products to make sure that our tactical data links and our satellite communication systems are secure and private. We use our cybersecurity solutions to put an extra layer of security on top of all of those things. And then, you know, we have products that bring things together. And we have one example is a program called XVI, XVISAT that we're working on with the United States Air Force, which is actually a Link 16 LEO satellite. And that satellite's really interesting in that it takes Link 16, which is a tactical data link, and is typically a line of sight interaction. And so users have to be able to see each other within a few miles or a few tens of miles. With XVI, a user on the ground will be able to interact with the satellite, and the satellite can interact with other users on the ground, or it can gateway traffic out through another connection, basically turning Link 16 into a beyond line of sight system that's interoperable with other network systems. And so this is an example of what JADC2 is trying to accomplish. It's taking formerly stovepipe systems that could only interact with each other and finding ways to increase their range and increase the number of users that they can communicate with. And Viasat has a wealth of products that are able to extend the range of terrestrial users, air users, maritime users, and create linkages between broadband systems and historically non-broadband systems. And so we're really excited about our ability to participate in these initiatives, and we think we have a lot to offer.
Okay, so you mentioned the Link 16 program with the US Air Force just now. As you mentioned earlier, the Air Force ABMS is just one element of JADC2. Based on what Viasat has been doing so far, not just with the Air Force, but with other stakeholders for JADC2, what do you think is a main kind of lesson that not just the armed services, but also industry have learned?
This is a fantastic question, because this is a really complicated problem. This is a really hard problem to bring these disparate communication systems together. And one of the things that we've learned over our history of doing this is you want to create interoperability at the network layer. And I'm not going to go too far down into the weeds of what the different parts of the network stack is. But this is the same lesson that we learned on the internet. You don't want to force people to use the same waveforms, which is the physical layer, or the same exact method of communication. You want to create interoperability at a higher level, at the networking or even at the application layer. And this is exactly how the internet works. When we think of the internet, the interoperability is at the TCP/IP layer, which is the network layer, or some people think of the World Wide Web as the internet, and that's an application layer. And so there's interoperability at the application layer, and there's interoperability at the network layer. And so it doesn't matter. I'll take this analogy a little further to the devices we use every day. It doesn't matter if your cell phone is using Bluetooth or Wi-Fi or 3G or 4G or 5G. It can interoperate with every other cell phone, because there's interoperability at the network layer with TCP/IP, or there's interoperability at the application layer with the World Wide Web. And this is the same approach we need to take with JADC2. We don't want to force users of disparate systems into the same waveform or the same low-level communications protocol. We want to find a higher-level communications networking protocol, maybe something like TCP/IP, or maybe something else that creates interoperability and still lets each user use its own waveform or low-level protocol, because those low-level protocols have specific attributes that work really well. A tactical data link might have LPI, LPD properties, or it might be encrypted in such a way that it's very difficult to intercept, whereas a different broadband connection may have a different set of properties that are important. And you don't want to get in the middle of that. You don't want to disrupt that, because it's just too hard to standardize at that level. And so that's one of the main things we want to see going forward, is we want to see interoperability at the networking layer, preferably based on existing open standards.
Okay. And I think what you're getting at is a movement towards a military Internet of Things.
That's exactly right. That's very, very, very correct. Sometimes we call that the Internet of Battlefield Things. But that's exactly what we're trying to move towards here. And that's the promise of JADC2.
And in terms of the ingredients of this future Internet of Things, it could comprise a mixture of autonomous technologies, heavy use of satellite constellations for various functions, and of course, artificial intelligence is going to play an ever more important role. From your perspective as a representative of US industry, which of these strands that will make up the Internet of Battlefield Things is evolving at the fastest rate?
Well, I think that the area that is probably the least well understood and is therefore moving the fastest, because there's so much room for improvement, is the use of data that's associated with all of these different things. Because as we start to proliferate from having hundreds of things that we have to command and control to having thousands or even millions of things that we have to simultaneously command and control. And if you extend that even farther and think of basically every user in the battlefield, whether it's the soldier in the foxhole, to the vehicles, to the weapon system itself, every one of those things is a sensor too. And so now we've got millions of ingredients that are providing information, and we've got millions of ingredients that need to be told what to do. And so how do you bring that all together? How do you process that data? How do you validate that the data is reliable? Some sources of data are more reliable than others. Some paths that the data traverse are more reliable than others. And when you get that data back together, how do you conglomerate it into one thing? How do you process it? How do you divine intent from that data? How do you control millions of things simultaneously? And then when you've decided to control them simultaneously, how do you give the right information to the right user at the right time, and only the right information so that he isn't overwhelmed? You know, a howitzer only wants to know about the things that are targets within the howitzer's range, and it doesn't care what's going on space on the other side of the world. And so the management of that data, that's a huge is a huge problem. And so that clearly that has to be automated because no human can process that. And the next conflict is going to be won or lost with data. How much of it you have, how reliable it is, how effectively you process it, and how effectively you distribute it. And you know, this is an artificial intelligence problem. This is a machine learning problem. This is a network interoperability problem. This is a variable trust architecture and cybersecurity problem. And the intersection of all that is the core of what DIDC2 is, but the ability to process, route, filter, track, and tribute data is where the most innovation is going to come in the space.
Okay. And obviously at the moment, the emphasis of JADC2 is on the US. Clearly, the various branches of the armed forces have been involved in a number of tests and exercises, but it's moving towards bringing in NATO allies into the program. And clearly, the US can't operate without interoperability with its allies on foreign operations. So how, from your point of view, is industry helping to disseminate, educate, and enable NATO allies to get to grips with JADC2?
And part of it is a lot of the same solutions that we offer to the US, we offer to the UK and our other NATO allies. Some of the tactical data links, like Link 16, some of the narrowband UHF capabilities we have, those are highly proliferated into our NATO partners as well. And so being able to create solutions that bridge tactical data links into broadband networks helps our NATO allies as well, because they use those systems. That's one of the main things about creating interoperability at these higher layers, because it makes the networks more extensible. It makes it much easier to bring partners in. And if we follow the model of the internet and we make it easy and frictionless for people to join, these initiatives can be successful. If we over-standardize and say, you have to do it this way at this level, it's going to create a lot of friction, and it's going to make it harder for our partners to join. And we're pushing those efforts and those solutions forward to our allies as well as the US.
So obviously, as you've mentioned, JADC2 is such a broad, wide-ranging program that it's inevitable that there will be a perception, or, you know, it might happen that there are occasionally missing pieces of the jigsaw that will emerge and will become apparent. You know, are the obstacles to, or the challenges to achieving the objectives of JADC2, do you think they're as much cultural as technological?
I do. I think, you know, we spent a few minutes here talking about technology, and there are absolutely technology hurdles here, but the cultural issues can be harder to overcome. And so, you know, there's a long history of defense organizations and even the services or components within defense organizations doing their own thing and going their own way. And so there's a level of healthy intersectional rivalry sometimes. But sometimes there's a level of unhealthy stovepiping where I'm just going to do it my way and I don't care what you're doing. And this has ended up in numerous occasions where things are not compatible and things don't talk. The classic example we see in the United States is the two fifth generation fighters, the F-22 and the F-35, have different tactical data links that aren't interoperable. So the two fifth generation fighters can't talk and need a fourth generation fighter that acts as a gateway between them to talk. And so this is an example of what can and does happen because of cultural divisions. And that can be harder to overcome. And so, you know, acquisition organizations need to change, personalities sometimes and leaders need to change, the heritage of doing it a certain way needs to change. And all of those things are people, right? And people often don't change. And sometimes it comes down to, you know, people have made careers of doing one thing or another. And if we radically change the way we communicate, sometimes those careers go away. So that's serious, right? It affects people's jobs. And there's a level of inertia there, too. And so we have to look at this culturally of what's best for the warfighter, what's best for the country, what's best for our allies. And there's probably some hard decisions that need to be made. And, you know, as an industry participant, I'm an outside observer. I have no control and I have an opinion here. But, you know, the services and the defense organizations really need to do some soul searching and say, how much do we want to do this?
I think we'll move on from JADC2 now. And I'm wondering, given, you know, the expertise that, that Viasat has, about the whole issue of space sustainability and particularly the growing problem of space debris in orbit. And, you know, how do you think this will hamper spaceborne defence technology, and is a solution in sight?
Yeah, well, this is a topic that I'm very passionate about and that Viasat is very concerned about. And it absolutely is an existential threat to space-based defense technology, because right now we're seeing a situation where technology has outstripped both regulation and sort of industry and government standards of norms and appropriate behavior. And there's a danger here that we can put too much stuff into space, especially LEO, too quickly without understanding the repercussions of what happens when it's there. And so one of the things that we're very concerned about is when objects in space collide, it creates a debris field. And that, you know, two objects can collide and create thousands or more individual pieces of debris. And, you know, one collision doesn't sound like a big deal, and space is big, and there's a lot of room in space. But what happens is when you start to have many thousands of things in space, and these orbits intersect, even if the probability of an individual collision is quite low, you know, one in a million or something like that, when you have thousands of things and they intersect thousands of times, you start having millions of chances of collisions. And so if you look at this statistically, it's actually quite likely as we start putting many thousands of things in space that we're going to see collisions, and those collisions will generate debris. The ultimate failure case that we're very concerned about is when you generate enough debris, the debris starts to interact with itself and create a wider dispersal pattern of the debris. The debris, two objects collide, creates debris, and then that debris starts colliding with itself and knocking itself around even more, and it creates
kind of exponentially multiplying problem.
That's right. It creates a chain reaction that's it's known as the Kessler syndrome, The worry is it's a point of no return where a debris field becomes an actual danger to use of space. It can foul an orbit and prevent the use of a given orbit, but it doesn't just apply to LEO as well, because the debris moves up a little and it moves down a little, so it can foul orbits slightly higher and slightly lower than once in. It's also an issue of things that are traversing through LEO. So if you're trying to launch into MEO or GEO, it can be potentially a danger to the launch vehicle.
On that point, the first Viasat 3 geostationary satellite constellation is going to be launched next year, I believe.
Yes.
Can you just sort of summarise very briefly, please, Craig, what kind of capabilities do you expect that the Viasat 3 constellation is going to provide for military and government customers like the DoD, for instance?
Yeah, we're really excited about the Viasat 3 constellation. And so just in a nutshell, what the Viasat 3 constellation is it's a constellation of geostationary satellites, three of which, that will be launching starting next year, and one over the Americas, one over Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and one over Asia Pacific. They start deploying sort of March, April of next year, and we'll finish deploying in early 2023. So in about 18 months from now, we'll have global coverage with the Viasat 3 constellation. Each Viasat 3 satellite has well over a terabit per second of capacity, which is far in advance of any individual satellite that's on orbit now or planned in the very near future. And so each individual satellite will also have thousands of steerable beams. And so we can direct traffic wherever we need to. It's highly flexible in that we can concentrate capacity very thickly in a very small area, or we can spread it very thinly across the globe. And it's reconfigurable in essentially real time to do this. And this is one of the advantages of the Viasat 3 constellation and GEO in general, is the flexibility to move capacity exactly where it needs to be, or to spread it thin, or any combination anywhere in the middle. And so this network will support a rich mix of users, from residential users to air and maritime users to high-value defense users. The satellite also has some very interesting capabilities in terms of it's very resistant to interference. And so features that you would typically see in a military SATCOM system like Skynet 6 or Advanced EHF or others, Viasat 3 does some of the same things in terms of being able to shape beams and create nulls and deal with interference in an automated way. And so this system is very secure, very resilient, very high capacity, and very flexible. And we're really excited about the capabilities it can bring for commercial and defense users.
Okay. And finally, you mentioned Skynet 6A, which is obviously a requirement for the UK MOD, and we're speaking to you from the UK. And I thought I'd ask you, take the opportunity of asking you, Craig, about your thoughts of the UK space strategy, which was published last month in September. And obviously the aim of the space strategy is to try and bring together civil and military space activities as part of a kind of holistic approach to combating various threats. But there's also going to be a defence space strategy coming out soon as well. Obviously, we're speaking from an outsider's perspective a little bit, but it's still interesting to ask you, what do you think industry should expect?
Well, first of all, I'm encouraged to see that the UK government has basically allocated over, what, £5 billion over the next 10 years towards this. So it's encouraging to see the commitment and the energy behind this. And I know that there's a lot of problems to be solved in space, and I'm really looking forward to the defense strategy one as well, both in terms of the MILSATCOM capability, but also alternate PNT and PNT capabilities that are the core parts of JADC2 as well. But mostly what I'm looking forward to is hopefully seeing a level of integration between the defense space strategy and the civilian space strategy. And so if you take this conversation all the way back to where we started in the JADC2 construct, or the MDI concept of creating networks that were formerly stovepipe being interoperable, so that users can have access to both depending on what's available or depending what they need. I'm really looking forward to seeing a level of extensibility or some way that the civilian and defense space strategy can leverage one another, because that's where we're going to get advantage. And that's where the US and the UK and our allies have advantage versus some of our peer adversaries, is because we do have these robust commercial markets and these robust commercial providers that are spending billions, or in some cases, if you add it all up, trillions of dollars. And being able to leverage those capabilities in concert with our bespoke defense capabilities is where we're going to gain advantage. So I'm looking forward to seeing the compatibility between those.
Craig Miller, thank you very much for your time.
Ben, thank you very much. It was good talking to you today. I enjoyed the conversation.
For over 40 years, Shepherd has led the defense and aerospace sector with magazines, equipment handbooks, and cutting-edge news stories. Shepherd now champions the best business information and marketing solutions across digital, so your business can have the decisive edge in everything you do. Make your team the competitive advantage. Partner with Shepherd today. Get in touch with one of our customer experts to discuss your needs at shepherdmedia.com.
You've been listening to another episode of the Weekly Defense Podcast. As always, a big thanks to everyone who took the time of being with us today. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed the show, make sure you like and subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Until next week, thanks for listening.